So you are beginning an acylation reaction today. And the mechanism we'll cover next time, it's similar to the mechanism you already learned, although we are using an anhydride instead of an acyl halide. And you haven't had carboxylic acid derivatives yet to know that reactivity-wise, acyl halides are very similar to anhydrides. But I'm more worried about the practical aspect of the lab, the fact that aluminum trichloride, which we've already seen aluminum trichloride again in the Friedel-Crafts reactions, you're using that same compound today, highly reactive with water. Why? What's that? Well, no, not just hygroscopic. It reacts with water. What about the structure of aluminum trichloride? How is it in any way unusual? Does it have a complete octet? No. That's why it's so reactive. Reactive enough that if you take the bottle, open up, wave a piece of pH paper over it, it turns pink very rapidly. What does that mean? In the way I said it this morning, it's hella acidic. Which there were one or two people that needed a few minutes to recover themselves, because one person in particular looked up like, no, he didn't just say that. No. Old man up there didn't just say hella. Which, and I told the story about me one time whipping out a few South Park lines in class, that really frightened the class. It's like, how does that guy know that? And then especially because I did the Cartman voice, and I didn't warn anybody first, and I just did it. I heard this kind of squeak behind me, and I turned around. This poor woman that was right in the front, she couldn't talk because she was so red and laughing so hard. She was like, my geeky O-chemist instructor just did that. Which then I made everybody really kind of go, wow, when I informed them that Google actually had supported a proposal to make hella one of the SI multipliers. You know, you have kilo, mega, giga, peta, etta, all these computer terms we use now because all the storage we got. So Google wanted to make the hella. So you can have the hella meter and the hella a second and the hella. I'm totally serious. You look it up. Of course, then I wondered, what are they going to do for the poor school kids? Are we going to make them say heck-a-meter and heck-a-second? Anyways. So back to the aluminum trichloride. The point of the story is, if you take aluminum trichloride and you leave that cap off, you're just going to be generating huge volumes of hydrochloric acid vapor, which you're going to be sitting there breathing in because you're right next to the aluminum trichloride. So you notice that we already have one of the balances in the fume hood. We can even move another balance into the fume hood if you need to. My lab lecture is going to be long enough that you're not really going to have enough time to properly do the lab today, which is fine because we're going to be canceling the last lab of the quarter. So we are going to do the acylation, but we're... There, I saw that. We are going to be doing the acylation, but not the competitive or bromination or whatever the second one is. So if you don't finish today, you can continue your heating and stirring on Monday, because we will have time to finish up the experiment. But you will have time to measure everything out, which is why I'm focusing on the measuring aspect, because you need to get that aluminum trichloride measured out. One of the things that kind of confused some people yesterday when they did the lab is you do start out with two separate flasks because the reaction is highly exothermic. And in fact, the normal addition process that I followed when I was in grad school is you start with the aluminum trichloride first and then you add directly to it whatever is going to be the acylating agent, which in this case is the phthalic anhydride. So normally you put those together, very exothermic, makes this kind of cake thing, which some of you are going to get that. Again, in the other sections, they kept getting the aluminum trichloride, the cake together. It's normal, and it will turn all kinds of colors during the reaction. So if you have brown, red, yellow, orange, even blue or green are possible. So don't worry that mine doesn't look like my neighbor. Well, yeah, because it's a Friedel-Crafts reaction. So normal process is to make that cake and then drip in whatever benzene substituent that you're going to be adding to that. But you're not doing that. You're throwing the two main reagents together, the xylene and the phthalic anhydride, cooling that off first to prevent some of this heat release, then plopping in the aluminum trichloride. So that's why the aluminum trichloride starts out in its own stoppered flask. You do need the stopper just when you're transporting, because again, do we want to fill the room up with buckets and buckets of hydrochloric acid vapor? No. Part of the reason for me telling you this story is that I've noticed in all three sections, bottles still occasionally being left with caps off. I hadn't whined about it recently because you all haven't been that bad. But if you're not that bad with a bottle of cyanide, you're still dead. So with the aluminum trichloride, you've got to be careful to keep that capped, because aside from breathing in all the hydrochloric acid, it's going to sit there and decompose. Now, there is the side story that I'll tell that I told the other sections. That back in grad school when I did these reactions, my advisor used to be just fanatic about reactions and reagents being clean. Turns out that hurts in a Friedel-Crafts reaction. Found out that just a trace of water is helpful to the reaction. So if you leave the cap off on your own reaction flask momentarily, turns out not a bad thing, not a terrible thing. Leaving the whole reagent bottle open, going to ruin everybody's experiments. So, same thing with the anhydride. Anhydride means without water. It means you reacted something enough, put enough heat to it, into it, that you pulled water out. Not just evaporating it, but structure-wise, caused dissociation of water. Which means that that compound's going to be really reactive with water. So, same thing. Leave the bottle open, it decomposes. Given that you all might have observed that maybe today I might be in a pleasant mind frame, but I have demonstrated some stress during the quarter. So if I were to see bottles left open like that, just expect maybe a strong response. That's my kind way of saying, grade-wise, I'm going to beat the crap out of you all if it happens today. So please keep those bottles closed. Now, aside from that, like I said, you won't have the full time to do the reaction, but we don't really have to worry much about side products in this case, because is xylene an activator or a deactivator? Oh yeah, you gave that same look the other sections of, ooh, we really should be able to answer that question right now, but I don't know what he's asking. Boy, I've got a lot of study. Are those the three thoughts that you all just had one in a row? Yeah. It's like, dang, how's he reading our minds? Xylene, activator or deactivator? What is xylene? See, that's problem one. If you haven't done your nomenclature, you know we have aniline, phenol, xylene, toluene, anisole, benzaldehyde, acetophenone, benzophenone, all these different molecules, thiophene. Xylene's got two methyl groups on it, doesn't it? Methyl group, activator or deactivator? Activator, due to hyperconjugation. But what happens after an acylation reaction? What does acylation mean? What is acyl? A carbonyl with some kind of R group on it, right? So you're putting a carbonyl with an R group on it, which means you're making a ketone. Ketone, activator or deactivator? Deactivator. So your starting material is much more reactive than your product, which is why you don't have to worry too much about byproducts, because multiple acylation is unlikely. So, you just do as much of the reaction as you can today, clean up, label everything. It does have to be stored with a cap, which, if some of you have been storing samples in your large pear-shaped flasks, if you could start working on getting those samples into the conical vials or other storage vial, because the stockroom is running out of used large pear-shaped flasks, and they don't want to have to break into their stock of back stock of glassware. So if you're needing to check out stuff, instead of that, start transferring your samples that you might still need into other pieces of glassware. Most of you probably won't get there, but just, again, to make us laugh before we go to NMR, because, yes, we're doing more NMR today, I'll comment on the workup for the reaction, because you pour the reaction over ice, isn't that correct? Which I didn't realize this, that I just presumed everybody heard this in your high school chemistry classes. How many of you are familiar in English with, at least, the alphabet? Meaning that acid goes to water. A goes to W. Not water goes to acid. You all have heard that before. Okay, most people hadn't in the classes. And what I mean by acid goes into water? Well, what would happen if you took a few drops of water and dropped it into a concentrated acid? It won't just evaporate, it's going to splatter. Why? What happens when you take concentrated hydrochloric acid and add it to water? It gets diluted, doesn't it? But hydrochloric acid, remember that HCl, the compound, is a gas, and the only reason that you end up with a solution is because it dissociates when it goes into solution. And it only does that because it's really, really compatible with water. Well, if you all of a sudden throw more water, there's more water that tries to surround the hydrogen and the chloride, and that ends up being highly exothermic. So if you take just a few drops of water and drop that onto a pile of acid, the water absorbs all that heat, boils, and splatters. Whereas if you pour acid into water, what acid gets added first dilutes, releases its heat, and that heat gets spread around in the water that's there. So in general, anytime that you're doing dilutions, you always pour acid into water, not water into acid. That applies here, even though we're talking about aluminum trichloride and we're talking about Lewis acids. Because, as one of my coworkers at grad school found out, when you take a liter-sized Diels-Alder reaction, where we're doing it on the mole scale, a mole of aluminum trichloride is something like 200 grams. So imagine that we're doing reaction on that scale, and she inadvertently pours the water and ice into the reaction flask so that a couple hours later, when it's still dripping off the ceiling, we realize, no, that's not such a good idea. It really does need to be the reaction poured into water instead. If you didn't catch that, dripping off the... Because it reacted so much, it all went all over the place. In a lab room that wasn't uniquely ours, and so we had these very, very serious health-conscious postdocs that were in there that... Oh, I got some dirty looks for months afterwards. Some practical experience there. So, questions, though, about doing the lab? Oh, one thing I should tell you, we're going to do half quantity, just again to reduce the amount of waste and materials being used. So otherwise, we'll do a more complete discussion on Monday. But let's now turn to NMR. NMR, we did an alkyl halide last time, and we did a benzene compound last time. So I want to backtrack and get to some oxygen-containing functional groups again. And I'll reveal the surprise we're going to do saturated functional groups this time. So give me a moment to pull up the spectral information. So our first problem is going to be C4H10O. And it has four absorbances, 3.337, that is a singlet that integrates to 3, 3.336, which is a triplet that integrates to 2, 1.59, which is a triplet of quartets that integrates to 2, and then 0.93, which is a triplet that integrates to 3. I'll shortcut this a little bit to say you should pull out your chemical shift tables. I know, if you don't have them, then crowd around the other people that have lab books. Yes, you can actually solve this problem without having to have chemical shift information. But you need to start getting the habit of looking for it, because not all problems are solvable by tricks. In fact, the next problem we do will be our first problem we approach purely on the basis of integration and splitting. No other tricks, you could say. I mentioned I'm talking smack about Section 1 now. Sorry, Section 1. But Section 1 this morning, they were working on the problem. I made the comment, wow, I don't see anybody with their chemical shift charts out. 2 minutes later, no one had budged. And so I made the comment, you mean the guy who actually knows a little bit about solving structures recommending to pull out your chemical shift charts and you're not going to do it? A slightly less subtle way of saying get your charts out. And just because you haven't even looked at a chart, you don't know how to look up a compound on a chart yet. So just got to make sure at least you can do that. So take a few minutes, work on the structure. For those of you who are getting good at NMR, let me go ahead and at least write the spectral information down for the next problem. But it's a functional group in this problem we haven't dealt with yet. So if you can't get this one yet, no problem. But just so that everybody's occupied, the next one will be CH88. And it's got 4 absorbances. I'll explain why this first one is a range in a moment. And for the recording's sake, let me read off this information. So again, this is C8H8. We have 4 absorbances. First one, 7.1 through 7.5. That's an M, which no, there's no number with M in it, but it is for multiplet. Meaning that the splitting pattern is either so complicated it can't be determined, or we don't care what it is, and it's easier to say multiplet. Next peak, and that integrates to 5, which that should be kind of an interesting red flag right there. How can something integrate to 5? Then next peak, 6.692, a doublet of doublets, integrates to 1, and has 2 splitting constants. I'll just go ahead and tell you, alkenes have a more sophisticated NMR signature than some other functional groups. Or we actually care about the details of the structure because we can tell from it what kind of alkene we have. So this compound, this particular absorbance, has 1 coupling constant that's 7 hertz and another one that's 12. Next peak, 5.737, is a doublet of doublets with an integration of 1 and 2 coupling constants, 2 and 12 hertz. And the last one's 5.225, which is a doublet of doublets, integrates to 1, that has 2 and 7 as its coupling constants. The first problem, C4H10O, how many degrees of unsaturation? 0 degrees of unsaturation. So there's going to be multiple angles that I work this problem just like we did the other day, so there's different tricks I'm trying to show you, except that a lot of the tricks end up kind of being combined together in this problem. But I'll call the first method, if you want to use that term, a combination of degree of unsaturation and integration. Because yes, the degree of unsaturation is 0, which means that it must be an alcohol or an ether. Now, I'll come back and finish this part of the story up in a moment, but since we're on the topic of alcohols, I want to discuss a little bit about alcohols. Because there's some other pieces of information that will be useful for solving problems with alcohols. Now, It appears that last quarter I may have discussed what happens to an alcohol if you add D2O to a sample, an NMR sample containing an alcohol. Does anybody recall that discussion at all? Because someone from one of the other sections kind of get, oh yeah, you did say that. Do we remember me talking about cyclohexane and how at low temperature cyclohexane has two signals, but at high temperature it only has one? I think it was in that same lecture that I talked about this phenomenon. At the same time I'm talking about alcohols, let me mention some chemical shift information, I guess. And this is all connected, what I'm going over right now. Because the proton attached to an oxygen in an alcohol, the book states that has a chemical shift of 4 point something. Oh dear, I already forgot the numbers. 4.5 to 9 energy. Yeah, 4.5 to 9. Yes? It is? Okay. But I disagree. I think that lower numbers are even possible, because I swear that I remember other compounds with chemical shifts of maybe even as low as 3 or 2 point something for an alcohol. Why is it that alcohol can have such a broad range of chemical shifts? And the answer is not automatically, oh, well, it might have different kinds of neighbors. No, just a plain old alcohol might have these very different chemical shifts for that hydrogen. Any reasonable guess is why? Okay, we might wonder if there's different interactions that occur with solvents. So what is special about alcohol that would make it more susceptible to that kind of behavior? Why do alcohols have high boiling points? Hydrogen bonding. Okay, so hydrogen bonding, that's a, a very pronounced form of dipole-dipole interaction. So if you're having hydrogen bonding going on between molecules, though, depending on the exact structure of the molecule, that's going to determine how much hydrogen bonding is going on. And of course, if there's any variation in that hydrogen bonding, that's going to change exactly how much electron withdrawing is going on the carbon the oxygen's attached to, or the hydrogen that is on that oxygen, so that's going to change the chemical shift. It also is related to the fact that at room temperature, at least, protons undergo very rapid exchange in solution. Alcohols are compounds with pKa's of 16 through 18, which means they're not terribly acidic, but they have some acidic character. And anytime you have something that's acidic, that means there's an equilibrium between it and its conjugate form. So in solution, although it's not favorable to be dissociated permanently, rapid association and dissociation of a proton occurs. That has two important consequences. One of them is this D2O trick that I was talking about. But let me write this thought down about proton exchange, because it actually has two consequences we're going to discuss. So at room temperature, alcohols undergo rapid proton exchange. I don't know if reassociation is really the right word in a chemical context, but you know what I'm trying to say. Hops on and off. Over and over and over and over again. So if you were to add D2O, and I mean a drop, yes, but realize that most NMR samples only have a very small portion of the compound you're looking for in the middle of the solution. So if you add enough sufficient D2O, and there's this constant exchange that goes on, then statistically you could just outnumber the hydrogens and force the alcohol to become its deuterated equivalent. So if D2O is added to a sample, proton deuterium exchange can occur. which, if sufficient D2O is added, can convert an alcohol to its deuterated analog. Well, deuterium and hydrogen, even though they're related chemically, they're not related nuclearly. There are two different nuclei, and so they're going to be scanned at two very different frequencies. So if you're doing proton NMR and you're looking for protons, you're not going to see deuterium. What that means is that if you had an alcohol peak and then you put D2O in, it's going to disappear. If you have a compound you don't know what it is and you add D2O and a peak disappears, that's strong evidence you have an alcohol and which specific peak corresponds to that alcohol. So it's a useful diagnostic trick. So since hydrogen and deuterium are different nuclei, which underneath means they have different what are called magnetogyric constants. It means how much does the spin get spun by being put in a magnetic field. That's what determines the frequency of absorption that occurs. So since they're different nuclei, they absorb NMR radiation at different frequencies. So when conducting proton NMR, the alcohol peak after exchange disappears. But there's another consequence as well. That has to deal with what's called the time scale. How quickly does an observation occur? Because it's not instantaneous. There's the sample is bombarded by EM radiation. It absorbs that radiation. There is some delay while that sample decays and the signal is monitored. So if during that acquisition of the signal, proton exchange is going on super rapidly, then splitting won't occur. At least observable splitting won't occur. Because for splitting to occur, you have to have one neighbor interacting with another. Well, this neighbor's too busy hopping off and on the whole time. Maybe it will get detected, but you won't see the splitting. That can make a problem complicated, because if you look at an alcohol, the hydrogen on an alcohol versus a hydrogen on the neighboring carbon, if this is not a tertiary alcohol, those are close enough to each other that they can split. So if you're expecting to see splitting, but you don't, then that can make the problem a little tough to work. Which, if you haven't figured out yet, this compound that I gave you is not an alcohol. But because it might have been, because we only have saturated compound, because we have no degrees of unsaturation, we had to know a little bit about alcohols. Had to go somewhere in lecture. Why not here? So, at room temperature, proton exchange is rapid enough that splitting between an alcohol proton and its neighbors will not be observed. I'll give you a moment to write, and then let's go back up to what we were starting on. which is how could we use the degree of unsaturation and then integration to solve the problem. Now, I am going to scoot this back up in a moment, so if you didn't quite finish, just leave yourself a little space, but let's go back now to that discussion. So, degree of unsaturation is zero. Means it's an alcohol or ether. Why an ether?
Because the signal is about 4.5.
Okay, so we could make a chemical shift argument. But let me argue back and say that that alcohol peak could have such a wide range that we can't conclusively make the statement off of just chemical shift. Now, you're normally right, but why else? And notice that the heading here is integration. How do I know from integration alone this is not an alcohol? There is only one oxygen. So if it was an alcohol, it's a monoalcohol. And all alcohols have one proton only on that oxygen. So if we have an alcohol and there would only be a monoalcohol, we need an integration of one. There is no integration of one, so it's an ether. Did you all follow that logic? An alcohol has to have one hydrogen, but only one hydrogen. If we had two alcohols, then we could easily have a compound that integrates to two. Ethylene glycol, for example, would have an integration of two on its alcohol protons. But we only have one alcohol, or only could have one because of the formula that we have. Since we don't have an integration of one, we don't have an alcohol. So since there is only one oxygen and no peak integrates to one, the compound is an ether. Now, this is another contrived example because there turns out to be only three structures possible. With four carbons and it being an ether, here are the only three possibilities. Because let me add up here on the degree of unsaturation. It must be an alcohol and ether. And there can't be any rings. It's not a cyclic compound, because remember that a cyclization counts as a degree of unsaturation. So again, these are the only three compounds possible. And you might want to prove to yourself these are the only ones possible. Try moving an alkyl group around, move a methyl from one place to another, and you'll keep just making the same three molecules over and over and over again. So the first one, what is one of the integrations that it's going to have that will prove that it's not the compound that's described by that spectrum? Because we talked about symmetry the other day as well, didn't we? So we have symmetry. We have two methyl groups attached to the same position, which means that these both are going to integrate to 6. Well, we have no 6 in this compound, so it's not that compound. Look at diethyl ether. Same thing. It's a symmetric molecule. The methyl groups are not attached to the same position, but the whole molecule is symmetric, so they're still equivalent. that means they're going to integrate to 6 as well. So without even looking at any splitting or chemical shift, we know that it is methoxypropane, 1-methoxypropane. Does anybody want me to cover this set of logic again? Yes? Okay. So the first part of it is about degree of unsaturation. Do you get that part of it? And so it has to be an alcohol or an ether. And if it's an alcohol, it has to have one hydrogen on the alcohol. We don't have an integration of one, so it can't be an alcohol. That part makes sense? Okay. Then there's only 3 structures possible. This is the reason why these trick approaches won't always work. Because if you have C10H18O3, are you going to write all 50 possibilities and then test each one? No. But with the small molecules, you can do those tricks, which is why we've been doing those tricks. Because these tricks you can use on a larger molecule, let's say that you get 90% of the structure, but just 1 or 2 aspects of it you can't get. That's the time for tricks then. So out of these 3 possible structures, the first 2 have symmetry. So they have integrations that will be greater than 6, or greater than 3. We only have 3 as the greatest integration, and so it can't be either of those 2 compounds. Now let's take another approach, though. Let's take the chemical shift approach. And let me recopy that chemical shift information about the alcohol. The fact that we have a broad range for the hydrogen actually attached to an alcohol. Then if we're on the carbon next to either an alcohol or an ether, they both have almost identical ranges. In fact, to simplify, I'll just make them the same. And I guess that is a case of making your data make the reality that you want. But 3.3 roughly to 4. Your book says one of them is 3.3, one of them is 3.4. But similar enough. And then if we have one more position away, so we're further from that electronegative oxygen, then that has a chemical shift of about 1.2. So, how does this information help us? Well, if really the low-end cutoff for an alcohol proton really was 4.5, then we don't have an alcohol, because we don't have any chemical shift that high. Of course, when Emerson suggested that as an answer earlier, I rejected it, saying, well, what if we're not sure? Well, what do we know for sure? That there are 2 peaks that have a chemical shift of 3.3. 2 different peaks. One of them integrates to 3, one of them integrates to 2. So 5 different hydrogens. You can't put 5 hydrogens on 1 carbon, so they have to be at least on 2 carbons. If we look at the chemical shift chart, 3.5 corresponds to having hydrogen on carbon next to oxygen. So what I just said a moment ago is that you have to have 2 carbons. That means we have to have hydrogens on 2 carbons, both next to the only oxygen in the compound. Well, 2 carbons next to an oxygen, that's an ether. So if you look at the fact that we have 2 chemical shifts of 3, we know automatically it's an ether. So then we're thrown back to the same situation as method one. But to not completely copy method one, let's take the total number of signals approach this time. Because again, if we knew it was an ether, then again we could generate those three possibilities. So how many unique types of hydrogens would we have in the first of these compounds? Remember the symmetry. Four? First one, on the left, I'm sorry. Three. Why? Because we already discussed how the two methyl groups are equivalent. And then we have this secondary hydrogen. And then there is the methyl group at the end. So three signals, which doesn't match the four that we have. What about diethyl ether? How many? Two. Because again, the molecule is completely symmetric. So we have the methyl groups on either end. And we have the... What was the term that I used to call a CH2 group? Methylene, which you can remember that from the compound methylene chloride. CH2Cl2. Of course, that means you have to remember methylene chloride, but you got to remember something. So, the two methylenes are equivalent to each other. So we have two signals there. Process of elimination, this last one better give us four signals. And it does. Because we have the methyl group at one end, the methylene one position closer to the oxygen, the methylene yet one more position closer to the oxygen, and then the methyl group on the other side of the oxygen. So let me repeat this bit of logic again. Looking at the chemical shift, I'm proposing that I was unsure whether or not there was an alcohol. Just in case the chemical shifts are a broader range than what your text states that they are. But I noticed that two peaks have that high chemical shift. Now that by itself might not necessarily mean something, because we're going to see an example in a moment where you can have two hydrogens on the same carbon that have different chemical shifts from each other. But since I have a total integration of five, that meant I had to have two carbons, both of them next to an oxygen, which is how I knew it was an ether, because there's only one oxygen. And then from there, I figured out, the possible structures. This is why back in Chem 12A, even though I didn't put this problem on the exam, this is why they have you in 12A. They give you a chemical formula, and they say, write every isomer you can think of, because that's what you do in NMR problems. So here are the three possibilities. Two of them won't match in terms of number of signals, and so the third one's it. Now let's do the most systematic method that we've done in any of the problems to date, purely basis of splitting. So we have one peak that is a singlet that integrates to three. What does it mean to be a singlet? No neighbors, no hydrogen neighbors. So there's only a limited number of ways we can achieve that. We did see in the ketone example last week, where because the carbonyl itself, when it's a ketone, has no hydrogens on it, that it prevents either group on either side from splitting with each other. Let me just write this thought down, and then let's look at what that could mean in terms of this problem. So, a singlet that has an integration of 3. Often indicates there is a methyl group with blocked splitting. I could come up with some example that might not be so. If I had some wildly symmetric molecule, you could end up with 3 different positions, all with the same hydrogen, all with singlets. Okay, just to prove there is such a critter. So this example molecule, the 3 hydrogens, would integrate to 3 and be a singlet. So it's not always true. But this is 12B, not grad school. So most of the time when I say you've got a singlet that integrates to 3, it's a methyl group blocked from splitting. What does that mean structurally? It means we can have something like this. We could have a quaternary carbon, or we could have a methyl ether, because the oxygen has no hydrogens. Who cares what the R group is? The oxygen has no hydrogens. So the methyl group attached to the oxygen isn't going to be split. Now, we have an oxygen in this problem, and integration of 3 means methyl group, so we could easily guess, then, it would be a methyl ether. But let's say this was a large molecule and we had lots of other peaks, and so we didn't want to make any direct prognostication based just off of that, what might be that R group. So let's start with one of the other peaks. We have a triplet that integrates to 3. Again, things that integrate to 3, especially in molecules, means methyl groups. But what does it mean if I have a triplet that integrates to 3, or 2? Sorry. Triplet integrating to 3 means what? Well, I got a methyl group. And that's what the integration tells me. What does a triplet tell me? That there are 2 hydrogen neighbors on the next position over. Now, why did I want to start with a methyl group? Why do I have this fixation on methyl groups? Because it's the end of a molecule. It's kind of like, anybody ever worked jigsaw puzzles as a kid? You know, once you got that corner piece, you were all excited because you knew there were 2 directions at least that you were going to be able to build off of it. Am I the only one that actually enjoyed doing jigsaw puzzles as a kid? Okay, there might be a reason I end up a chemist. But anyways, this is what's going on here. We're starting with one piece of information that we think we can get our hands around and then build from there. So I started with the methyl group, now I move one position over. Because that's what the triplet tells me. Fine. Now let's go back to the spectral information. How many peaks do I have that have an integration of 2? Only 2 peaks. So these 2 hydrogens must be corresponding to one of those 2 peaks. Which one? Pretend I didn't ask you that question. If I just look at this and look at the blue hydrogens and I ask, what's the splitting going to be for the blue hydrogens? What would you say? Well, you got 3 neighbors over here, don't you? What do 3 neighbors cause? So this has to have a quartet. There's only 1 peak that integrates the 2 that has a quartet. It's a triplet of quartets. That's what this peak has to be. I'll do that one again because I got that what look just now. I started at the methyl group. I knew from the methyl group's splitting that my neighbor had 2 hydrogens, which also means the next thing along has to be either a carbon or an oxygen. I know that much just from 1 peak. But now let's move 1 peak over. Okay, I'm in a peak that has only 2 hydrogens. Is there something that integrates to 2? Yes. One that's a triplet, one that's a triplet of quartets. If I just came from my methyl group neighbor over here that has 3 hydrogens, that means I have to have a quartet. So the only possible peak that that 2 set of hydrogens corresponds to is the triplet of quartets. All right, fine. So the quartet comes from the fact that we have the methyl group neighbor. The integration of 2 is because, well, that's the peak that we're talking about. But what else do we have? A triplet. What does that mean? There's 2 more neighbors that are not equivalent to the first 3. Because if all 5 of these hydrogens involved were equivalent, we'd have a hextet. So, the triplet means 2 different neighbors. There is only 1 other peak that has an integration of 2. What is it splitting? Triplet, right? So the integration of 2 is because we're on that particular methylene. What does the triplet mean? 2 neighbors. We already know which 2 neighbors. The blue ones. But if we have no other splitting, that means there's no neighbors on the other side. So I started with a quartet. Started with a triplet. I knew from that there were 2 neighbors. The 2 neighbors were a triplet of quartets, which quartet matches the fact that just came from a methyl group, and the triplet tells me I've got 2 more neighbors on this side. That peak itself is just a triplet, which reflects the fact that I've got 2 neighbors on this side. But because it's only a triplet, that means I've got nothing over here except a quaternary carbon, which can't exist because I've already used 3 of the carbons up, or the oxygen. Which, since from above I already guessed that this was a methyl ether, that means the compound is this. So again, this is purely an argument by splitting, and I successfully solved the structure systematically. But as logical as it might be to sit back and listen to it, you know, if I say that 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 1 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 plus 1 plus 2 plus, you know, go back and forth, and this triplet and quartet and doublet and this one, it integrates and blah, 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 and there's the structure, right? It does take a little more effort to do it that way. Yes? Nope. Question was, on a lab quiz, am I going to ask you to do a specific method? No, but you're going to end up doing this one as part of it. Because the lab quiz problems will be slightly larger molecules. Yeah?
Is it possible to have a 5 neighbors?
5 neighbors? No.
You
never will have a hextet. No. Well, except in real life, what can happen is if you have 2 different sets of neighbors, but their coupling constants differ by 1%, then when you run the compound, you're going to see a hextet. That's why it's called the N plus 1 rule, because N plus 1 works even if you have multiple neighbors that are different, if their coupling constants are the same. Now, you were about to... I'm going to give you 2 problems to work over the weekend after you've had your exam. And we're going to talk about those on Monday, and that's going to be your hardcore prep of how would you approach an NMR problem. But with the little time I've got left, which I don't actually have, but I'm going to take it anyways, let's do that one other problem that I put up earlier. Unless there's more questions about this one. Not that it makes you feel any better, because right now I can tell the collective mood is, please let it end, at least in terms of NMR. There are whole courses just on NMR. So if you're thinking that must be the case, well, yes, it is. So that other problem, and let me just flash that up here. Let me flash it up here where you can actually see it, though. C8H8, how many degrees of unsaturation? 5, okay? And actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy and paste that bit from one sheet to the other, so you don't have to flip back and forth and back and forth. It takes 2 seconds in Photoshop. So, degree of unsaturation of 5, chemical shift greater than 7. What functional group must I have? Benzene. Remember, we just did the example the other day that, yes, degree of unsaturation of 4 does not automatically mean benzene, but in combination with that high chemical shift, it's hard to think of a functional group otherwise that would give us that combination. Now, integration of 5, Locke was just talking about how that shouldn't be possible. Because how can you have a symmetric compound with 3 and 2? And actually, yes, you can have an integration of 5.
Since this is going to be pasted over anyways once I do the Photoshop. There's your integration of 5. That's called a crown ether.
Because if you have a really vivid imagination, which I guess chemists sitting around sniffing solvents and stuff in the labs, they get a vivid imagination. So five oxygens that are like the seat of the crown, and then these groups coming off of it, these are chelators, meaning they like to associate with particular ions. So depending on exactly the structure of your methyl groups, the number of oxygens, and whether they are oxygens, sulfurs, or nitrogens, they tend to preferentially bind to particular ions. Because I'm just randomly thinking of this, if you were to shape these types of systems more carefully, maybe make them planar, make some aromatic structure around it, put a nitrogen on it, call it a porphyrin group, we end up with hemoglobin. Hemoglobin has an iron center to it that also binds to heteroatoms that are in a cyclic arrangement. So crown ether might not have been something that we got into when we went over the ether chapter, but crown ethers are hugely important compounds. If nothing else, because it lets you take an organic molecule and bind it to something ionic. So if you have a mixed phase, aqueous, organic reaction, you can bring reagents across the phases. Anyways, in this problem, if we know that we have benzene, how do we get an integration of 5? If you only have one substituent on the benzene ring. Given that that consumes 4 of the degrees of unsaturation, we only have 2 carbons left, and there's 1 more degree of unsaturation, the compound is styrene. So I didn't even look at the rest of the information, did I? World's easiest problem. The reason I'm doing this problem is we're going to figure out, of the remaining absorbances, which one is which one of these protons. Because there's 3 different protons in the alkene, and which one is which. That's why we're doing this problem. But now, why is it that I listed this with chemical shift of something through something? Because in this case, once we know that there's a monosubstitute of benzene, who cares what the splitting pattern is? Every monosubstituted benzene is going to have the same theoretical splitting pattern. It changes depending what the substituent is, exactly the nature of that pattern. But since we don't care about it, that's why we're lazy and say multiply it. That's also why we're lazy and we say that those 5 hydrogens integrate to 5. They're not chemically equivalent. There are 3 different hydrogens there. But if we're not bothering to distinguish the splitting patterns from each other, and all we care about is the structure of the compound, we lump it together and say, there's 5 benzene hydrogens. So we don't do this for every functional group, but it's very common for benzene to be lazy and simplify. But then we do have 3 other hydrogens, and let me go ahead and mark those off here. And I'm going to give you some information that helps determine what kind of hydrogen is which. Because there are 3 spatial interactions occurring here. First, can we accept that the hydrogens that I circled in green and red are not the same as each other? They may be on the same carbon, but they're not at all in the same chemical environment. Why? Is there any bond rotation that could occur without a chemical reaction that would let you flip the 2 hydrogens? No, it's a pi bond. If you tried to flip, the whole compound spins unless you break the pi bond. So if they're permanently locked into this configuration, that means the hydrogen that I circled in blue permanently has a cis interaction with the green hydrogen. Whereas it instead has a trans interaction with the red hydrogen. Now, I know the term cis and trans, when we learned naming, meant functional groups, substituents of an alkene. But we can talk about 2 hydrogens being cis to each other, or trans to each other. And since this is a double bond, they're locked into that configuration. And so since they have different interactions, they're different chemical environments, which, as you can see from the spectra, causes two different chemical shifts. On top of that, because the green and the red hydrogens are not the same as each other, we have geminal interaction, twin interaction. So, for geminal splitting, that usually has a coupling constant between 0 and 3 hertz. Now, why is it hertz, not chemical shift? I don't remember. I gotta go back and study. As far as solving the problem, doesn't matter at the moment. You just need to know that numerical information. Cis, that has a coupling constant of 6 through 14 hertz. And trans has a coupling constant of 12 through 18. So yes, there is a little bit of overlap between cis and trans. I'm going to make sure whatever problems I ask, I make it relatively clear which one is which. Because if you had a number like 7, not high enough for trans. If you had a number like 14, but you already had a number 7, you can't have two transes, so you know one of them has to be cis. How's that helping our problem? Well, we have... Oh, poo. I just realized. In order to color code and all that, I'm going to have to rewrite these chemical shifts. So let me just do the three that we care about at the moment, the three alkene ones. And actually, I'll abbreviate. I'll just write their coupling constants. So, coupling constant of 2, geminal splitting. So we know which two hydrogens are the geminal ones. Once we know which two are, we know the one that isn't. So, the one that's neither the geminals is the one I circled in blue. Now, what about the remaining two? Well, this is exactly the type of situation. Coupling constant of 7 versus coupling constant of 12. There's no way 7 can be trans. It has to be cis. Which the only interaction that could happen that's cis in nature is between the blue and what I've circled in green. So this is the green hydrogen. The trans, that is the greater splitting constant. You might look at that and say, wait, trans, that's further away. So how do you have more interaction further away? Well, what if there's orbital interactions involved? And what if it happens to just be the right geometry in the trans position versus the cis? Well, that is the reason. But we therefore were able to distinguish between the three types of hydrogens. Why do we care about any of that? Well, what if we had 2-hexene, but that could be cis-2-hexene or trans-2-hexene. With coupling constants, we know which one it is. So now that you are all thoroughly leveled, or working on your bio homework, let's give you two problems for you to take home. I'm not going to do it to you. No, absolutely not. But for the next year, NMR might be the perfect take-home quiz topic. Well, that's what Fisher used to do. You know, he'd give everybody a different problem and say, go off and solve it. And since everybody had a different problem, no one could share answers. And I have his bank of problems, so I could do that. Maybe I will next year. Yet again, another reason why it's good you took it this year and not when I come back.
Here are the two problems. This one's a bit more robust than the first one. Robust is a polite way of saying hella hard. Someone asked, Dr. Gray, where do you get these problems? Thinking that by getting that answer to that question, they'll be able to go look all these problems up, download all the answers, memorize them, and be ready for the lab quiz. I'm just guessing. But I am getting them all from that same website link that's on my website. The AIST, I think that is, the Japanese website that has all the NMR and IR spectra. That's where I do get these problems from. But I get them by sitting down and thinking, what's a cool-looking molecule? Is the spectra available? Yes. Is it interpretable? Yes. Okay, it's a problem. There's one.
Look, it's only got six absorbances.
Five. One, two, three, four, five.
Actually, this is the problem that showed up on the lab quiz either 2 or 3 years ago. And 1 year, actually, this problem showed up in 12A's lab quiz. Because somehow, and I don't know how, we must not have done any lab, but I know we did. So how we did it, I don't know. We must have gone through all that NMR theory and all the NMR we did this quarter in 12A. Imagine what that 12A class was like.
Here's another problem for you. Now, things have definitely changed because when I first started teaching at De Anza, the type of multi-step synthesis that you did on the first exam, we did that in 12A as well. I guess I'm mellowing with age.
Now, I'll give the same disclaimer I think I've given every time I've given any of these problems to take home. You do it, you do it. You don't do it, you don't do it. You won't learn a darn thing coming to see me do the answer in front of you. It's just like one of the students in one of the sections, I saw flipping a pin around, you know, with their fingers, but it was like levitating. It was like, right? And you can show some of that. Here's how to flip a pin. Blah, 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 blah. Can you sit down and do it? Same thing. If you work through the NMR problem, you're going to get stumped. And then you're going to get upset. At least at some point, no matter how much you hate chemistry, no matter how deep a purple passion you hate chemistry with, at some point you're going to be like, no, God, I'm smart enough to get this problem. I'm going to work on this one. I'm going to show them I can get this. And then you're going to get stumped. But at least you've been through that. So that once you see me do the answer, it's like, oh, that's the one thing I was missing. Not the, oh, that's how you do the problem. Here's the one part I didn't get. That's where you need to be if you're going to survive the lab quiz. Now, how many times have I taught this course? Therefore, how true do I know it is that if I say you don't do this practice problem, you're going to be hurting on the lab quiz? So you can either choose to believe me or not. You do what you want to based on that. Have I made my message clear? Questions? Do we remember even one word of what I said about the lab and what things to do and not do? Shall I quickly remind us? She was like, yeah, let's just get it over with, please. Aluminum trichloride, don't leave the bottle over or it's going to be, the results will be sensational. The anhydride, don't leave that bottle open. We have the balance in the back there so you can measure out the aluminum trichloride. Get as much of the reaction done as you can. You will not have the full time, that's fine. The stockroom closes at 2:10. Make sure that anything you've checked out, you return by then. Remember that I'm counting the milliseconds until my lunch, or more appropriately, I should say that I have office hours that I'm not supposed to be missing, so 2:25 I'm supposed to be there, which means if I don't get out here by 2:15, I'm not going to be back there in time. So it means I need to get out of the lab at 2:10. Let's get to work.